You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Hi, my name is Carolina Jimenez. I work for the Latin American Program and for the Latin American and for the International Migration Initiative. The idea today is to have a discussion on the issue of domestic work. Most specifically on Central America and the movement around domestic workers' rights in the region. Early this year, the Latin American Program and IMI commissioned a report to understand not just the problems faced by domestic workers in Mesoamerica, but also to look at one specific organization, a current Lab IMI grantee that has been successful at advancing strategies in favor of domestic workers' rights. And here we have today Beatriz Slotin, our guest speaker, who researched and composed the report that we will be discussing. And well, Beatriz is an expert policy analyst on labor rights, employment strategies, and labor migration. She's a national of Costa Rica, but currently works and lives in Washington, D.C. Her work includes skill labor gap analysis, institutional design, designing to mitigate those gaps, and research on transnational migration and labor market. She's worked with different international organizations, including the Inter-American Development Bank, the Organization of American States, and the International Labor Organization, as well with think tanks such as the Inter-American Dialogue. It's a pleasure to have you here, Beatriz. Thank you very much for accepting our invitation. And Beatriz will initiate the discussion with some ideas about the recently approved convention, the Convention 189 on domestic workers. But she will go beyond just the analysis of the convention and describe some of the main problems regarding domestic work from its roots to the current situation in Central America. We will first hear Beatriz give us some ideas of context, etc., and then, of course, we will open the floor for questions and answers. So, okay, so I give the floor to Beatriz. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, everybody in New York and the people here in D.C. Thanks for having me. I was going to start with the ILO definition in the Convention 189, but it might be a little too technical. So let's go first with the question, where does it come from? Where does the domestic work come from? And well, the answer is from slavery and servants in payment for debt. So for example, in Costa Rica in 1858, the employee had the right to go with the police to look for the domestic worker if she wouldn't show up at work. This is 1858. I mean, it's not that far ago. This relation will end when the employer's life ends. And sometimes as a payment for debt, then it will be a payment with any limitation of time. So it would be like forever. There are a lot of issues that we have to always consider when we talk about this topic, and is our social issues. Like, for example, that women are naturally caregivers, because that is something that would trap the domestic workers, I mean, in the mind of the employer and actually in the mind of the society, right? Because they're supposed to be very gentle, they're supposed to give out care, they're supposed to take care of the elders, take care of the children. So there is not a very clear boundary between that you're supposed to do and a job. Sometimes, for example, the employers will say, they're part of our family, we are protecting them, and as the leader of one organization once told me, if we are part of their family, how come we don't live the life as they do? Which is true, they're not part of a family, they're employers. So now, how it has developed? Well, it's good, it's been developing around the world. One of the big changes was that in a year ago, well, actually 2 years ago, in June, in the ILO, there was a big convention around this topic, and they had the Domestic Workers Convention, the 189, which is a really huge advance. That's recognizing that they are one of the most vulnerable people, workers, in the world. So that's a big change to start. And there's a lot of changes in the due to this. Some of them are ahead. Some of them are as a consequence of the ILO convention in the countries and local laws. But, and we can say, for example, in Brazil, there is, which is the biggest amount of domestic workers in the world in a country, is 6.5 million domestic workers. That's what the ILO says. The number of maids shrunk from 7.2 in 2009 to 6.7 in 2011. Now, what does the definition says? It says it's a convention and recommendations, and they're founded on the fundamental premise that domestic workers are neither servants, nor members of the family, nor second-class workers. One of the most common problems that we have in labor laws, in local labor laws, are that they are a different category of workers. So that, by law, won't allow them to have the same rights as the rest of the workers. They'll have different schedules, different salaries, different benefits. The main rights given, this is the ILO convention, to domestic workers are decent work, are daily and weekly, at least 24 hours, rest hours, entitlement to minimum wage, and to choose the place where they live and spend their life, or their leave. Ratifying states, parties should also take protective measures against violence and should enforce, or furthermore, have a right to a clear, properly written communication of employment conditions, which should, in case of international recruitment, be communicated prior to immigration. They are furthermore not required to reside at the house where they work or to stay at the house during their leave. One of the main problems in domestic workers is, and for the states, is to enforce and measure their protective activities for them. I mean, why? Because how do you get a Department of Labor inspector to go into all the houses in a country? Just imagine Brazil. You don't have enough inspectors, and that's the problem about, that's the invisibility of these workers. They can go through a lot of things and nobody will ever notice. So how is it nowadays? Like in Latin America, how is the current Latin American situation? Well, first we have to consider that Latin America and the Caribbean is a region with extraordinary levels of income inequality. Latin America, for example, in Latin America, domestic workers will represent 11.9% of all paid employers, followed by the Middle East with 8%. In Latin America, the laws tend to be special for domestic workers, as I said, with special categories. And the ILO established when preparing the report for the 99th meeting that they are one of the most vulnerable groups of workers in the world regarding legislation. For example, in Brazil, a law implemented in April that is designed to modestly improve the lot of domestic workers is causing a fury. Everybody's really mad about it. It caps their workload at 44 hours a week, and it grants them 1.5 pay for overtime and a month of vacation per year. Yet, it is being described as the end of civilization and economic revolution on a par with the abolition of slavery. Domestic workers in Brazil, which are 60% black and 90% female, where there's a lot of articles in media about this change, which doesn't seem to be a huge change. About the ratification of Convention 189, It's really important to know that the first country to ratify the convention was a Latin American country. It's Uruguay. And there are 11 ratifiers, including the recent ratification of Costa Rica, which is also important because it's a receiver country. We have Bolivia as a ratifier. We have Guyana, Nicaragua, and Paraguay as Latin American countries that ratify the 189 Convention. Now, what is the issue with migration and domestic workers? For example, in Latin America. It's very distinctive in Latin America, domestic workers sector, that they migrate in within Latin America, the north to north migration, because there are a lot of differences between economies, and the change in the country will benefit the salaries and the remittances for their families. For example, Costa Rica and Nicaragua is one of those important examples. But it makes them, as migrants, they are more vulnerable due to the lack of regularity. The working permits are employer dependable most of the times, or actually I don't know any case where it's independent. So you depend on the employer. If you are regular, your status will depend on your employer. The salaries tend to be lower. The migration system is not always related with labor inspections, and migrants don't feel very comfortable filing complaints in foreign countries. So they're not as protected as they could be in their own environment. Institutions sometimes do not react how they should be, how they should react with this migrant. For example, health institutions or educational institutions. We have a lot of cases where educational institutions won't accept the children of the domestic workers because they're migrants, which is a personal decision because it's not in any law that you should not accept them. And in the health system too, because of xenophobic countries. In some cases in Latin America, race is another issue that migrants have to go through. For example, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. I mean, you have all these situations that would make domestic workers vulnerable. And in Dominican Republic, you can actually see a difference just in the way they look. So the discrimination is really fast. It's really immediate because of race. Now, I would like to go and make an analysis of the situation of domestic workers, especially in Costa Rica, and then finish with the analysis of the organization that we were researching on. So, in Costa Rica, the labor code will define domestic workers as servers. Domestic servers are those persons who dedicated in a continuous ways to work in cleaning, working, helping, and any other activities related to a household, home, or particular residence, without representing any business or profit for the employer. That's the Department of Labor, the Ministry of Labor. What's the local situation of domestic workers in Costa Rica? Well, UNIFEM in 2010 establishes that the population of migrant domestic workers in Costa Rica is approximately 22,000, representing 17% of the total population of migrants, which is 130,000. We believe it could be a little more because this is an official number. We believe it could be a little around 30,000. We made a research in 2011 to profile the domestic workers in Costa Rica. And these are some of the characteristics that we found out about this mostly women. Their average age is 36 years. 50% of them finish school. 30% of them finish high school. 50% of them have children in Nicaragua. 20% have children in Costa Rica, 70% of them are mothers, 21% of them are not regular. 60% do not have health insurance. Now consider this, 60% do not have health insurance and 70% are mothers. 48% take care of children as part of their duties. 23% take care of elder people as part of their duties. 34% of them washes the car as part of their duties. And 41% didn't get the Christmas bonus, which is an obligation by law. And 46% haven't received any vacation. Now, we're going to go, I'm going to change the topic and talk about this organization in Costa Rica that has been working in advocacy of domestic workers' laws and domestic workers' rights since 13 years now. The name is Astradomes, it's Asociación Trabajadoras Domésticas, is a domestic workers association. So last year we started this research, and the objective was to write the story of this organization and to learn some lessons so we could use them, or someone could use them, to strengthen other organizations around the world. Domestic workers organizations. They've been very successful in their job. They changed the law in the constitutional level, and they changed the law in the local level. And well, they didn't change it exactly, but they made a lot of advocacy in the process. And they're very related to all the changes. They also worked for the ratification of the Convention 189, which was recently ratified less than a month ago in Costa Rica. So let's go through this story. They started as a union in 1990, and they started very small, just with one person. She was very empowered to work in this union. And as soon as they started, they tried to change the constitution, which was not successful at the time, but they did it 5 years after. Right now, it's an organization of 500 affiliated women, and it has an assembly of 35 people and a board of 5 people. The presidency is held by their leader, which is called Rosita, since 2002. Now, why were they successful? Why were this organization so successful? And why, I mean, it's a very known organizational. Everybody is talking about the organization. There's not an organization like this one, so strong, with so many members, and with so many changes in the law like this one. I mean, it's a big thing that Costa Rica accepted the ILO and ratified the ILO convention, because it's a receiver of migrants, and migrants, they tend to get in jobs like domestic work and, well, agriculture and security most of the time. But the population is not very open to this type of changes. It's very xenophobic. So one of the things that make Astradomes a very successful group was the leadership. The leadership of Rosita was very strong. She's a woman that was formed with the Social Party in 1970s, and she had her own struggle, her own fighting. And she was also a domestic worker who was abused in her rights, human and labor rights. She got very empowered by this party and by a specific organization, and she started this union in 1990. Now, the story is very interesting that they started as a union, and my personal opinion would be that they should be a union, and they stopped being a union because because of a recommendation, like an under the table recommendation of the Department of Labor, because they just couldn't achieve anything. So they told them, listen, I mean, it's really complicated to get a union and to get all the paperwork for a union. Why don't you just become an association? That's easier. And they actually changed from union to association. And right now they don't want to become a union because they don't want to be part of the federal unions. But it's really interesting that it was actually the system who convinced them to stop being a union. Which, as a group, they're more likely to be a union than an association. So the leadership of Rosita is, as I was saying, is she's a very committed person. She's very strong, the way she speaks and the way she addresses to the people. She's a natural leader, and well, she's not comfortable with the situation of domestic work. She's been a victim. She's been there. She's been empowered people, and she's been facing political people to this change. But just to tell you a story, so you can figure out how she is. She once went to the ombudsman office. She wanted to have an appointment with her, and the ombudsman, of course, wouldn't give her an appointment. It was a woman. So she went to she talked to the guard, security guard of the garage, and the security guard told her which was the car of the ombudsman person. She waited there like for 6 hours straight until the ombudsman chief went out to her car, and she addressed her right there, and she got the appointment, and she got the support of the whole ombudsman office. And well, that's the way she did things, and that's the way it worked for her. I mean, I know this is something that we should consider in different countries, because it might be something in the context of Costa Rica that you can do that. Some other countries, the security will be a little stronger. And but I mean, she had in another situation, she got close to the president, Laura Chinchilla, and she actually grabbed her from the arm, and she shook her, and she told her, you have to approve the ILO convention. Well, the security was there immediately, but she got her point across. As I'm saying, I mean, this is not like something that it has to be done, but that's the leadership that she she develops. Alliances were another important thing of this organization, of the evolution of the organization. The alliances were very important for the organization to have a lot of success. They were very good at creating alliances, and they would try to ally with everybody that would commit to their goal. And this will include international cooperation, like the ILO, like the IOM. And it will also include people in the government, like this, the Ombudsman Office and the Women Rights Office too. And they will look for allies in different topics. One will be in women rights, in labor rights, and in migrant rights. So they were very smart in that way, looking for alliances. They have a strong organizational capacity. They represent a lot of domestic workers. When they speak, it's not only one person speaking. They know there's a lot of people backing them up. So they let the workers be part of the association without paying anything or without attending. I mean, they just leave it really open to any domestic worker to come. I mean, they can just come one day to an English class, and they don't come back, or they just can't come for a workshop in labor rights, or they could just really be involved, and they will be very free in that sense. So it seems that for this woman, that is very important, because they don't feel trapped.
Can I ask a clarification question there? You said that they can come to these events without paying any fee, but is it not true that they have a membership fee?
They do have a membership fee. Yes, they do have, but they don't. Most of the time, they don't pay the membership fee.
So many people have not paid the membership fee.
I mean, sometimes, for example, they actually most of the times, Well, right now they're a little more popular, but before they would have four people working in there voluntarily, completely voluntarily, and their costs, their operational costs, will be as much as $100 a month. And they will have their husband come in and help. And those $100 a month will be from memberships, but from few people that will help them in that particular moment. But they don't have, and that's something that we're gonna look into it. I mean, they're not very financially strong in that sense. They're not good business administrators. They're also always waiting by the phone to answer and help other domestic workers. They're trained in labor rights, and they're trained specifically in this type of labor rights. They know all the situations that domestic workers go through, so they have this open line, this open phone line, where domestic workers will call and ask for advice. And recently, like 5 years ago, they have a lot of questions from employers that wants to do, I mean, now that they're very popular, they just want to do things right. And well, they're very smart to call this group, so they call the group and ask them, listen, how do I do the vacation part? How much do I have to pay them? Do you have a contract that I could use to hire the domestic workers? They also have strong negotiating skills. And sometimes they had to negotiate rights, which is a really hard decision here, in order to achieve some benefits, and they did. When you are negotiating with lawmakers, with Congress people, diputados, that's the way we call it in Costa Rica, sometimes they will tell you, okay, what you want, I mean, you want to change on a daily schedule of 12 hours into 8 hours because it's rightful. Yes, it is. It won't be done. It just can't be done. We have to go from 12 to 10. And then wait a couple of years and go from 10 to 12, up to 8. And they did accept it. They did accept it. As different as a union that, in my experience, I believe they wouldn't accept it. So that's something that really helped them as a group. For example, in Nicaragua, they have another office in Nicaragua. Even though they don't have any political color, they don't have any political affiliation, in Nicaragua they had to go through certain type of affiliation because the official party is very strong. And that was the only way to get the convention approved. So they did go and talk to the official party, the Sandinista party. There's another thing that is very interesting in the organization, and is how clear they have the agenda. And I think this is something that really got them very successful. They always follow their goals, and they didn't get around with some other things. Even though they needed money, they would never compromise their agenda for funds, for example. I mean, if someone will come, because they had opportunities, for example, in the LGBT topic, I don't believe it, but if it was the ILO or the IOM who approached them and told them, listen, we want to work the LGBT topic in domestic workers, we can fund a project, and they said, no, we're an organization that only works for labor rights, and our goal right now is this and this and this. And no, we won't do any project going aside of that goal. And they didn't. And their agenda is never compromised. Even though they have to go back to $100 a month, they do it. They know a lot of the local environment. And they always took advantage, or they try to take advantage of political timing. For example, when the government starts, when the politics are making campaign because of electoral changes, or when there's a recess in Congress, or when everybody's looking at Costa Rica because of an international complaint. So they're always there around, and they're very smart in that sense. They know who to approach, and they learn it through time. And another thing that is very important is how the people regarding human resources and the finance, the resources that we actually went through that already, it's how the people that work inside the group is so loyal and so committed to these issues. They can work for free. And I mean, they had problems, they lost their jobs, some of them lost their jobs because of this fighting advocacy process. Some of them, or most of them, have family problems because of this, and husbands are not always very supportive about having a leader in the family. And they really faced a lot of problems, and they're still there. And even though they don't get paid, I mean, they'll go and do the core, like educational something, and they just go around the neighborhood and knock on doors, and neighborhoods where they know they have domestic workers, and they will knock on doors and wait for the domestic worker to open, and just try to get them involved in the group and try to tell her about her rights. They will choose special times, for example, December, which is a time where labor rights are very, very avoided, because it's you have to get the Christmas bonus, and all the migrant domestic workers would like to go back to Venezuela, to Nicaragua. So there are a lot of not rightful practices, like paying them off and then rehiring them so they won't accumulate rights through time, or if they don't come back, or for example, they don't pay them in full, they pay them half, so they will make them come back from Nicaragua, because some of them stay, which is, of course, it's illegal. So they will go in December and talk to all these people and work in workshops and send their volunteers to the neighborhoods and knock on doors and tell everybody, the employer or the domestic worker, how the rights are supposed to be played. So to finish, I would like to speak about some learned lessons that we have in this group, and that it's very important if you or whoever works again with another type of organization, of domestic worker organization, especially if it's starting. So the leadership building is key. You have to really identify the natural leader or form a leader. And this leader should be familiar with the political environment. They should learn basic topics of labor rights, human rights, migrant rights, and the topics related to the specific context. At least in Costa Rica, there's a big part of migrants. It doesn't happen the same in Nicaragua, for example, but there's a lot of domestic workers too. It's just that they're not migrant, or at least they're not international migrant, transporter migrant. The organizational capacity. It is recommended to have a structure in these organizations. For example, for the financial issue, to assure them a higher monthly income from the members. Or in the organizational capacity, to try to make these organizations unions, so they will have more access to training, they will have more access to international spaces where they can actually change laws. Or groups within the government where they can talk about salaries, talk about health. Because as an association, I mean, they're no different as a neighbor association. They don't have anything related to labor rights if they're not a union. They cannot do any collective bargain. They cannot be part of the ILO, for example. I mean, they went to Geneva when they were speaking about the ILO Convention, the 189, when it was approved, but they didn't have any voice because there was just an association. And they have to explore, and it has to be explored ways to incorporate misrepresentative population. For example, in Costa Rica, in the board of this organization, Because by law, you cannot have any, well, that's one of the reasons that they changed to association. By law, you cannot have any migrant in a board, in any organization in Costa Rica. So in this type of organizations, it's very important to have migrants because it will be, I mean, you have to have them representing the population, and well, it can be done. Actually, in their board, they have two migrants that became Costa Ricans. It's very important to strengthen the alliances with specific Congress people, because they're the ones who propose the law projects, with other organizations like the academia, media, international organizations, local organizations. And it's very important to have a basic knowledge of the environment. I mean, there are some things that are really, they're really painful to learn at the end of this talk. For example, that women will be their passionate enemies. The congresswoman would be the ones more strongly opposed to this type of laws. Not the gentlemen, but the ladies. So it's a myth to believe that they will have any type of solidarity with this topic. At least that's what the experience taught us in Costa Rica. Domestic workers are always scared. They are scared because they can lose the job and they need the job. And political environments are very dynamic, and momentum has to be identified to make law changes. But there is still a sense of ownership, along with discrimination and really weak legislation on this topic.
Well, thank you very much. I think you have provided us with
a lot of information
from the macro, right? Social and cultural patterns of discrimination to a very good study case, which is Astrada Homes as an organization that has been able to change laws in Costa Rica and Nicaragua. So thank you for the overview and for all the information you provided. I'd like to open the floor for questions, comments, etc. Maybe we should start in New York. And then continue and take some questions here in DC and give Beatriz the opportunity to answer them.
So thank you so much for sharing all that with us. So I'm curious, I know you said that that the organization was really good at developing coalitions to build support for domestic workers' rights. But I'm curious. I'm sure there is still some pushback from employer groups or employers in general. I'm curious, in those countries that have signed on to the new convention, or to the ones who have not signed on, what have the circumstances been like in those countries that signed on that enabled them to be successful? And in countries where they have not yet signed on, what are the big obstacles there?
Okay, maybe we can check if you here in DC have any questions, Max?
I have many questions, but I'll ask two. It's always been a problem, I have too many. So one question, if the church plays any role and is in any way passionate about migrant workers' rights or domestic workers' rights together, the church, and particularly the women's rights component of it that you mentioned, if they're at all vocal, are they supportive, are they negative, etc. So that's one question. And another question, so you referred a few times to the budget of the organization being $100 or $100 a month operational costs. So what is the actual annual budget, I guess, is part of that question. But also, are you at all in any way afraid of organization losing real touch and being real grassroots with the funding increasing, if that would be the case? I understand that it's a big part of the legitimacy of the group as well, the way you talked about the leadership style, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe I understood that wrong.
Can you repeat that last question?
Yeah, so you said that they would benefit from more funding,
yes,
the group. At the same time, the way you describe the group and the real grassroots efforts that they undertake and some of the leadership style, etc. So my question was, are you not afraid, or do you feel, do you have any sense of caution around the group increasing funding and therefore maybe losing its grassroots identity?
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Can I? Yeah. Can
yeah,
I?
Yeah. Maybe we should.
Give, yeah. So I might forget.
We should. Yeah. Give her the chance to answer, and then.
So. So they've been working 10 years now about the funding, and they will be going on and off. And every time they increase their funding, they did a lot of really good things. I mean, the good part that I was trying to say is that they wouldn't depend like 100% in funding. I mean, they can actually operate without any funding in really low cost, which give them a little flexibility. And so they won't disappear if the funding disappears. That's a good thing. Most of the time, the funding that they use is very well allocated and is funding for, they have like a certain type of methodology, and they will have, for example, this type of activities, lunches or breakfast with decision makers, and they will really go after them and tell them, this is what we want, this is what we should change, and that's what they do. And they've been very successful about that, because as the other person in New York was asking, it's very complicated that a place like Costa Rica actually approves and ratifies this type of convention, and they had a big part in it. So I would say, I mean, I'm not talking about $1 million, but I would say I wouldn't be cautious in that. I mean, they prove they have experience managing budget. The church, that's a really interesting question. When we profiled domestic workers in Costa Rica, and I didn't mention that, but the biggest affiliation of all the migrants, domestic workers, is the church. I'm not sure which one specific, which church specific, but yes, most of the churches in Costa Rica will go through, I mean, they will work on labor rights, and they will have a big part in it. Mm. And the why they don't ratify, why countries don't ratify, definitely it's a position of the employers regarding the question that he was asking. Most of the time, the employers are against this type of regulation, because it means that a lot of local laws had to be changed. Well, as you know, I mean, if you ratify an international convention, then you have to align everything that you have on a local level, so the convention will be accomplished. And yes, in Costa Rica, one of the biggest problems were the employers. The National Employer Association was against it, and it is against it in the rest of the countries, and that's why it's not being ratified. And in here, I believe it was there was a lot of advocacy, a lot of pressure, so it will be ratified. If that answers your question, hopefully.
I had a question about the different types of domestic model legislation that's based on the ILO. How relatable are they from one jurisdiction to another, and are there cross-border coalitions that are advocating for similar types of legislation in different countries?
Thank you. I don't know if this was in your findings or not, but domestic workers sometimes within a country have different economic situation than domestic workers that have been able to migrate. I mean, being able to migrate, you already had certain support to be able to pay for the cost to go to Costa Rica, for example, or Nicaraguan domestic workers are at a, as far as you can go from home sometimes on what you have in your family income, sometimes permits you to have a different social economic strata. So I was just wondering, between the domestic workers that Astrodomics works with, they work with not only migrant workers, but also local Costa Rican, or in the case of Nicaraguan domestic workers, and if there's any differences that they see. And you talked about the women and women's rights groups not necessarily always supporting them in their causes, but do you see any differences between the domestic workers themselves, between the migrant workers and the domestic workers that are more closely
the national
domestic workers?
What type of differences?
Like, do you see the same support? Like, for example, Astrodomes is a domestic workers association, so they don't differentiate between whether you're a migrant domestic worker or a national domestic worker. And sometimes there can be different social, economic differences amongst your domestic worker population. And so I was just wondering if there was any differences between how those members of the association related.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Take Pedro and Pedro.
You can do it in the next round.
Yeah.
You prefer to answer now?
Yes.
And then we take, okay.
But I always put you on hold.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
So there's no rush.
All right, between migrants and... Well, there is an organization, it's a regional organization, it's called CONATRAO. Yeah, it's not easy, but yes, it's an association of domestic workers associations in the region. And there is a platform for Latin America too, but the most advanced is Costa Rica, so it is in the advocacy and in law changing. And about the ILO, laws, if I remember your question, well, the convention is really wide. I mean, it's really, it's not specific. I mean, what it says basically is that any domestic worker should be a decent worker, which is a concept of the ILO that implies a lot of things. So it actually doesn't go in any detail, but it will set up a framework for all the countries to change the laws. For example, what I was saying at the beginning about the different category of domestic workers being part of a different category of workers, if you ratify the convention, if the country ratifies the convention, that has to be changed. You cannot have them as a different category. You would have to have them as the regular workers with a regular salary. So, for example, in terms of Costa Rica, that's the only thing that the convention will, that and international recognition, of course, but that's the only legal thing that the convention will make the country change, because the other ones were already changed. But for other countries, it will mean a lot of local changes. And differences between migrants and local domestic workers as you know, migrants, well, they migrate because of looking for better opportunities. So there is a lot of remittances. So economically, they are more vulnerable than Costa Ricans, because they will send a lot of money back and they will keep less money. There's a lot of cultural appreciation differences. People will say that one is that it works more than the other one. And what they do is they will exploit her more than the other one. And that's related to migrants. And, I guess those are the differences. I really don't know if you
want. I don't know if there's any divisions between their
within
membership.
The domestic workers?
Within the association.
Oh, yes, definitely.
Or
definitely.
Any difference in strategy of how they're working with national groups versus
No, they try always to work in the same strategy, and they try to make them part of it. And even though they cannot be legal part of a board, they'll still make them illegally but very formal part of decision making. And they're very inclusive in that sense. For example, Nicaraguans have special holidays, religious holidays, that they will only have in Nicaragua, and this association will have them in their local space. So they will because I mean, well, they're doing a transnational cultural thing, so they will celebrate both. So they're very inclusive that way. Am I missing a question?
Okay, maybe we should first go to Kathy. Yeah, <please. laughs> and then Tasha. I don't want to miss
it's not a burning question. It's just a long-standing question, especially for grassroots organizations that are based on membership.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, how do you go about cultivating enough new leadership so that the organization is not dependent on one leader? My understanding is that Rosita has been there for a long time. I don't know how much longer we can expect for Rosita to be there. And what is the organization doing to try to develop those new levels of leadership? So it's one thing to do kind of training so that people know what labor law is, know what migrants law is, know these different things. That can happen at a number of levels. But to actually kind of work on leadership development, what is the state of that, I guess I'm wondering? And to what extent does a lower level of leaders beneath Rosita speak in public, serve as a spokesperson, lead a particular part of an advocacy campaign? That's my question.
Yeah. I had two questions, and the first one is exactly that. So. You were clear that they could survive without, new funding, but less clear on if they could survive without new leadership. How dependent they are on this specific leadership. This is always a risk when we know the advantage of count on charismatic leadership,
right, yeah.
But this risk is also enormous, the fact that the person is not there anymore for any reason, could lose the strength of the organization. So this was the first question. And the other one was, I think there is, I followed quite closely the Brazilian debate about it, this issue. And of course, the counter argument that always appeared was that if we increase the rights, we would lose employment. Mm-hmm. This is always...
You would lose what?
Employment.
Right.
I mean, it's because it'll be more expensive. Exactly. This is again. And of course, this is not a reason to stop including the rights, but there is something behind this. There is the fact that maybe those are employment that we want to lose because we want to build a society. I mean, the fact that Brazil, for example, have this amount of domestic workers, mm-hmm. it's something, there's something wrong mm-hmm. with the way that domestic work is viewed, because it's so cheap, it's people are not, they assume that this is something that is completely needed in the house, because it is something that is not well paid, it's not, there's no value, social value that is attributed to it, and when you begin to do it, when you begin to recognize when the weight begin to increase, there is something about, of course, and that's why maybe Brazil is now decreasing the numbers of, and I think this is a good thing. Unemployment rate in Brazil is really low now, so exactly. So there is something about this strategy that is, how thinking more big picture about it, how to deal with this idea that, yes, I mean, we want to increase the rights because, in a way, we want these jobs to disappear because we want to build a society where, and of course, this cannot be part of their speech because they're not saying, mm-hmm. but how to deal with this tension that it appears in this, the fight on the domestic work.
Thank you. Tasha?
Sure. So thank you, Beatriz, for your presentation. It was very nice. And I wanted to ask, you had mentioned, obviously, that domestic workers are some of the most vulnerable populations of workers that are. But within that realm, it seems that domestic workers that work for certain types of peoples are even more vulnerable. So particularly diplomats or international actors, because they're not necessarily held, they can't be held to national law. So is Astro Domes working on targeting perhaps those type of workers in a different fashion, or trying to tie in their advocacy to more international level? Because time and time again, you know, these workers are the most vulnerable, and it seems, you know, it's very difficult to approach. So if Astro Domes is doing anything at that level, or if you know of other organizations that are also that are trying to.
Well, can I answer?
Of course.
Well, no, Astro Domes is not doing anything in that matter. There's not, well, that case is not very. Well, I've never heard of it in Costa Rica. I mean, I heard it in Geneva, and people from the Dominican Republic, actually inside the ILO. So, but no, Astra Domes is, it just doesn't have any type of those types of cases. Not that I know of right now. And that big question, right, about wanting these jobs to disappear or not. Because that's a question that I actually did myself when I was doing the research. Because sometimes Astra Domes would like to teach the domestic workers to speak English and to use computers. So you would ask them, why would you do that? Because you want them to get a different job. So you're actually aiming to change this, or I mean, what are you aiming for? And that's a question that is. It's not clearly answered, definitely. My opinion will be that the jobs, I believe this type of job would never disappear. I mean, it's a job that we need. It's a base of a pyramid. People should, or I mean, we need people that take care of kids and services, of this type of services. But we would definitely will be aiming to disappear the low payments, the bad treatments, the not right access. And if that will make them more expensive, and that would reduce the capability of families to have one or two or three, it has to be it, like it happened in Brazil. I mean, the population shrunk like around 2 million people because of that. And leadership, that's a big question that actually raised in the research, and I guess I skip it. I had it in here. There is a strong leadership in this woman, but she and the organization also is building they already built another leader, which is ready to take over. The thing is that the other leader is, oh, there's nobody in New York.
Yeah, there is.
And there is another one, but she just works a different leadership. Her name is Carmen, and she's not as noisy, as loud, as Rosita is. She's different. She uses a lot of social media, and she just manages a different leadership. But yes, it was hard to get there. I mean, it had to be Rosita that went, that said, okay, I'm too old, I'm sick, I need to pass my power to someone else. I mean, it shouldn't be like that. It sounds like a dictator story, yes.
I was just wondering, I'm dissecting a bit the women's groups and their relationship with Astro Domes. I mean, it makes sense to a certain extent. If you're not able to hire a domestic worker, you as a woman are doing more work in your household.
Right.
So that's kind of how cultures have laid it out, and that's how gender balance is in a lot of these. And so what you see in many countries with the domestic workers is that allows the woman of the household, the mother, to be able to do, you know, outside employment or other types of activities that kind of frees her up from those duties. So I was wondering if there is any more exploration on what the dynamic is, I mean, to bring those groups together to talk more about kind of the gender roles of women and gender and how domestic work fits into that. Because your immediate response would be, of course, don't take her down to, you know, 8 hours a day. I need her 12 hours because I can't afford to pay her more, and that will mess up my whole, you know, kind of layout for my day and, mm-hmm. and what I'm trying to do professionally or et cetera. So I don't know if they've entered into any, like they found common ground, at least on the gender issues, and have maybe entered in to having the dialogue that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess not exactly in this level, but it's a really interesting question, and they should, I don't know if they enter in another level, because in here you're talking about a grassroots, very grassroots organization that it will hardly get into this type of discussions. I mean, they will just be very strong in their advocacy, and then this type of discussions will be held in another environment, and not that I heard of, not this gender. I mean, maybe ILO has some talks about this, but not that Astral must promote or became part of it. It wasn't their target, but I'm pretty sure there has to be. But not that I know.
Many of the academics researching on domestic work start these discussions without the domestic workers be part of the discussion, because they don't think about it in those terms.
Yes, and yes, you're right, that's the reasoning. I mean, they had fights in common. Rosita was taken with security out of a Congress meeting because she was so mad at it, screaming at a woman that told her that, I don't know, all those ugly things that they could say about domestic workers. So I don't think there's like a space where she actually sat down and talked about it.
Because, I mean, you peel back the layers, and at the end they share a common issue of
gender imbalance.
Yes.
But it may be that there needs to be some kind of other convening actor to bring mm-hmm. those groups together. Because if one of them reaches out to the other, that's directly.
Yes.
It's a little difficult.
It's a confrontation,
because for the women's groups, they can be concerned after seeing the video of Rosita yelling at somebody on the wherever.
Exactly.
that they're going to be kind of put with their backs against the wall and required to make a decision that they're not prepared to do yet. If somebody else would convene them, like a church group or something. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of things at the table. I mean, in that discussion, like, for example, what about the state and what about providing childcare and
the other policies.
Exactly.
I mean, if you're going to hopefully have a society where you don't have somebody trapped in a small room in your house 24/7 to help with childcare, that the state has some other options for working families, I mean, that need that childcare.
Yes, but they don't.
Right.
So, yeah.
One thing just to that I, so you said that an employer's association had an important role trying to stop, and because in the present case, it wasn't so much about employer's association. I mean, I have a domestic employer association that are strong, you know, to make noise. And it's much more the fact that all the journalists, politicians, they have domestic workers.
All
so
the
it is much it's much more subtle the way, you know, the pressure would come in the discussions, and not, you know, like the traditional lobby that you could know exactly who is doing pressure and so how to counterbalance this pressure. I don't know in Costa Rica or not.
Yeah, it was exactly the same thing. I mean, and it's such a small country, so everybody knows everybody. And yes, all the people in Congress would have a domestic workers. And even when we made the research and we spoke with congresswomen that were in favor of this type of law, they were actually telling the story how they were raised by a domestic worker and. All those sad stories. And yes, I mean, they're the ones against the laws, but against the convention, since it has to be tripartita, I mean, with the three of them, with the unions, the employers, and the state, in order to ratify a convention, that's where the employers will come and stop it, in that level. But in Congress level, you'll find a lot of people stopping it.
Thank you. Is there any other pressing question or final comment? Well, if not, I just wanted to thank you once again for coming and giving us this very useful and great presentation. And thank everybody for coming. Thank you, New York, for also joining us. And yeah, we look forward to continuing the discussion in the future.
All right. Thank you. All right. Thank you.